you'll notice our hymn made two references to why would I alone in the wilderness rove, and also why about crying in the desert for bread. That is tied in with the topic that he's going to address us on, part one, in the wilderness, part one. And I believe it has something to do with Revelation 12. Brother Harry?
Good morning, brethren. It's a privilege to be here. Lots of blessings. We had a wonderful night of fellowship, evening of fellowship at the Martins, Brother Russ and Sister Camille with the Kutchers and Sister Emily, and have my dear Sister Karen with us this time, so we're very happy. Let me just a tiny bit. Oh, okay. You do what you need. Okay. So here we are. Well, our topic is in the wilderness, and before I start, I just want to say one thing. How wonderful the truth is. On the way here, Sister Karen and we were driving up Route 47. You know, it's a little two-lane road. You know, it's a main two-lane road. We pulled off to get gas and let the dog out, you know, doing that, and everything was fine with us. Car goes zipping by us, and about 300 yards late, and I wasn't really paying attention, you know, because we were off the road getting gas. And all of a sudden, boom! No screeching of tires, no brakes at all, just two cars hit each other, which I believe at full speed. One car, it was so violent that a huge SUV was over on its side. Well, other cars were now, you know, slow, you know, gradually, it wasn't real busy, but they were coming up. I called 911. I said, there's been a terrible accident, two vehicles, there are injuries. Here's exactly where they are. So, you know, three ambulances. We took another way around. But, you know, the world is so distracted. They're so distracted. They're not even paying attention where they're, you know, they hit each other at 60 miles an hour, probably head on, where no brakes at all. I mean, and that's just a sort of a metaphor for the way mankind is going, not just literally in. But we have the solutions. You know, we look at this Memorial Day weekend. The rest of the world, they can go out and mourn at the graveyards. We don't do that. We're working on the solution. So we want to keep working. Well, our title is In the Wilderness. And this is a phrase that is used in Revelation chapter 12. For the first thing we're going to do is go over Revelation chapter 12, and I really appreciate that because because God is never going to forsake his people. He's never going to leave them in some situation where they don't have the nourishment and strength and support and everything they need to make their calling election sure, because he loves them, regardless of when it is tough love. In that previous discourse, is the world doesn't understand tough love. It's essentially it. So you can't reason with him. But what we like to do is we like to go through Revelation chapter 12, verse by verse. And this is really sort of the prelude to the main point we want to do. What we want to do is talk about the wilderness condition in Revelation chapter 12, then go to the first four or five verses in Revelation 17, when the angel takes us in the Spirit, into the wilderness in the Spirit. How can that be? And why is that so important? And when you're in the wilderness, in the Spirit, what can you comprehend? So if you want to know about that, be here on Monday. Okay? There's something mentioned about tapes. But I think you read that, you read the second volume, it's going to be very clear. But we're going to go through Revelation chapter 12, verse by verse. And I'm glad we have, you know, an hour and we have some time to do it, so I don't have to, you know, zip through. Revelation 12:1. And there appeared a great wonder in heaven, a woman clothed with the sun and the moon at her feet, and upon her head a crown of 12 stars. So we have this a great wonder in heaven. First of all, what heaven? What is heaven? Well, that's a place of control. In this case, ecclesiastical control. In other words, what was really the ecclesiastical influence that was going on here? Well, this was the early church. This religious ideas that were had. This woman was clothed with the sun, with the light of the gospel. Where does light come from? It comes from God, right? It comes from God. So the light of the gospel. And when we think of that, this is the covenant. This is the Sarah feature of the Abrahamic covenant, which is now being comprehended by those who God wanted to be his children, that to be the joint sacrifices with Christ. So it was a very favored position. With the moon under her feet, in other words, the heritage of the law, understanding what righteousness was, because it was actually given in God's law, it was done by Jesus himself, and the true church had faith in the one who did it, and they didn't make void the law by faith, they actually established the law, Paul tells us. So they had a tremendous regard for God's law. Upon her head, this crown of 12 stars, really a picture of the 12 apostles. On the head, intellectual appreciation of the teachings of the 12 apostles, some more prominent than others, Paul, Peter, etc. But when you take a look at this state of the early church, it was really a very favored state. It was very strong. It had a good understanding. So they had wonderful, wonderful beginnings. And this is why when we want to study, we want to go back to what they said. We want to go back to the early church. We want to look back at the apostles. We don't look at many of the writings later, at the vast, vast majority. We look at the scriptures in Jesus' day and the writings of the apostles. Well, in the first two centuries, from this very strong beginning, Christianity was really confined to the lower classes for the most part. This is not something that the upper classes were interested in, because the lower classes were the ones who understood this is going to be a tough way. This is going to be a way of sacrifice. You're going to have tough experiences, but these experiences are for your own good. In many of the lower classes, they didn't have a whole lot to lose anyway. They were very interested in this. They were committed to this. They understood that. They were willing to lay down their life, and they had seen many others lay down their lives as well. They knew the lay of the land. This is not something new. They knew what they were getting into in these first two centuries. Plus, these sufferings are exactly what Jesus told them to expect. This was not a surprise. They knew this. There were persecutions. There were, it's interesting, there's a big stone in the Colosseum that it has an inscription on it. But the original inscription was some bronze letters that were pinned into the side of it, and it essentially says, this Colosseum was built by Octavius Caesar, or Tiberius, from the loot that he brought back from the destruction of the temple in Jerusalem. So that's where they got the money to build the Colosseum. And then who got killed there? Well, the early Christians. They were fed to the lions. Well, these early Christians, they kind of realized, here's what's going on. This was not a big surprise. But their faith, these ideas, these concepts were so important to them that they laid down their lives. And that's really the picture for us. And for all of the body of Christ to realize, this is a tough way. This is not a wake-up call, oh, guess what? No, you know this before you're getting into it. But in the third century, and this is according to Will Durant, in the third century, and the third century is in the 200s, in 261, so this is about, 70, 80 years before Constantine, there was a fellow called Galenus, and he published the first Edict of Toleration, recognizing Christianity as a permitted religion, and ordering that property that had been taken from Christians should now be restored to them. So he says, let's back off. Let's be a little more lenient. After all, Christianity is getting a lot more popular, a lot more people. Well, I don't want to alienate all these people. Let's have an edict of toleration. Well, what does that do? Well, the church can now make rich converts. And again, this is quoting from Will Durant. The church made rich converts now. They built costly cathedrals and allowed its adherents to share in the joys of this world. The odium theologicum, which meant odious, subsided. In other words, odium, the idea was, previously Christianity stank in the popular ideas of the empire. But this odium of Christianity was now subsided amongst the people. Christians intermingled more freely with pagans and even married them. And in the interval between Decian, which is about 251, and the Diocletian persecution that I think we're very familiar with, which began in 303, this is a period of 60 years or so, well, about 50 years, the church had become the richest religious organization in the empire. Now, note, this is well before Constantine. This is before Constantine. This is before Diocletian. And had moderated its attacks upon wealth. In other words, the church itself is not saying, hey, you shouldn't be wealthy. They're saying, well, that's okay to be wealthy. That's okay. Well, Cyprian, he was a bishop in Carthage, and he was very zealous. And he'd been complaining that his parishioners were mad about money, that Christian women painted their faces, that the bishops held lucrative offices of state, they made fortunes, they loaned money at usurious interest, and they were willing to deny their faith at the first sign of danger. In other words, they were a bunch of wimps. They weren't interested in sacrifice. They were interested in wealth and prosperity. Eusebius mourned that priests quarreled violently in their competition for ecclesiastical preferment. And this is before Diocletian. And Will Durant says this, and there are a few embellishments I made, but that's mainly a quote from Will Durant in Caesar and Christ. But he says, while Christianity converted the world converted Christianity and displayed the natural paganism of mankind. Well, what's the natural paganism of mankind? Natural paganism is hedonism. You want enjoyment, wealth, luxury, and everything that goes with that. You don't want to do anything tough. You don't want to work. You don't want to sacrifice. So, in other words, Christianity, which was to be a way of sacrifice, had become a way of luxury and prosperity. Reminds me, some years ago, there's a fellow I knew, this about 15 years ago, and this guy had a lot of trouble in his life, and he said to me, Harry, you seem to have your act together. What do you do? I mean, this fellow was sort of a verge alcoholic, and he was in a company I was working with at the time, and he was groping for how can he clean up his life. He was looking for a self-help program. And I didn't say this to them, but I'll say this to you. Christianity is not a self-help program. It's a self-sacrifice program. It's just that while you're doing the self-sacrifice, you learn the principles, which is the greatest help and greatest benefit that could possibly happen. But it's a self-sacrifice program. But during this time, even before Diocletian, Christianity, which should be a way of sacrifice, had become a way of luxury and prosperity, so that the state of Christianity just prior to the persecutions of Diocletian was in a very, very bad state. These are folks, for the most part, didn't want to sacrifice. Revelation 12:2. Here we are. She, being with child, cried, travailing in birth, and pain to be delivered. So she, here's the woman, the early church. This child is something developing associated with her. Well, many in this early church, so-called, they wanted relief from the bitter persecutions of Diocletian. And they desired a favorable union with the empire. Now note, for the sisters who've had children, I think you are one person. The child is a different person. You are separate. You are separate. You're not the same. And also, that when the woman is travailing during childbirth, it isn't because of the mother, it's because of the baby. If the baby weren't there, there'd be no travail. It's because of the baby. Well, what was happening is it's this component within the church that had developed or closely associated, called themselves Christian. They don't want to sacrifice. They're in it for the goodies. They're not in it because of their faith. Let's go to Revelation 12:3. And there appeared another wonder in heaven, and behold, a great red dragon having 7 heads and 10 horns and 7 crowns upon his head. Well, the great red dragon, this was pagan, the pagan Roman Empire, really the civil power in its successive and distinct forms of government, which is 7 heads, 10 horns. That's why it's defining who that would be. Again, quoting from Will Durant, that Constantine, what he was interested in was stability of the state. He wanted to become a monarch. He wanted to have the stability of the state. And Will Durant mentions that pagan civilization was founded upon the state, and to a Roman, his religion was part of the structure and ceremony of government. In other words, the Roman religions, whatever they are, they're a function of government. The whole purpose is for stability of government. It really has nothing to do with is there a God or what should you worship or what's right. It's what is most beneficial for the state. That's the whole purpose of religion to the Roman Empire. Well, Constantine, looking at these early Christians and looks at the persecutions they'd been through for about 10 years under Diocletian's rule, he says, well, despite the bitter persecution and bitter oppression, they rarely had revolted against the state. Their teachers had inculcated submission to the civil powers. I mean, here's Paul talking about the Roman citizenship, you know, be subject to the rulers. They'd taught the divine right of kings. Well, the king is there because God has set him up. I mean, don't rebel against him. I mean, this is God's will. If it's happening to you, it's God's will. Constantine aspired to an absolute monarchy. Such a government would profit from religious support. Now, he knew this from all the emperors previous, which we're going to talk about later, you know. And the hierarchical discipline and ecumenical authority of the church seemed to offer a spiritual correlate to monarchy. Perhaps that marvelous organization of bishops and priests could become an instrument of pacification, unification, and rule. That's what he wanted. In short, Constantine wanted to use this new religion to his own end, but this would mean uniformity of religion. We can't have chaos out in this Christian religion. We have to have uniformity. We got to get this thing under control. So instead of the oneness that was spoken by Paul in Ephesians, when Ephesians 4, 4 through 6, where he says, there is one body, one spirit, even as you're called in one hope of your calling, one Lord, one faith, one baptism, one God and Father of all, who is above all and through all and in you all. What Constantine wanted was one state, one religion, one Pontifex Maximus, period. That's what he wanted. Absolute oneness of everything. And we're going to talk about that a lot more a little later. Well, through the Council of Arles in 314, which was really to address the Arian controversy. I mean, there's these different ideas about the nature of Jesus and these theological disputes. Arian wasn't really interested in the theology of it. He was just saying, let's just make this go away. It's really we don't. It's the controversy itself. I don't care what it's about. We just have to get rid of the controversy. And later, through the Council of Nice, to settle the controversy by decree and by force, Orthodox Christianity was now codified. They finally came up. This is what it's going to be. And with this, I mean, if you've looked into that, you'll find with the Council of Nice, they've now have the Trinity, hell, the mortal soul, the works. They've got it all pretty much all figured out. The so-called Apostles' Creed, which I learned when I was raised in the Presbyterian Church, that was the Nicene Creed. That's what defined Orthodox Christianity. That was orthodoxy. So here's where they are at this point. Well, and, oh, by the way, and Constantine might have said, now, if you don't want to agree with me, that's okay, but just keep in mind, I killed my wife, my son, let's see, was it my wife, my son, and there was one other.
Brother-in-law.
Okay, there you go. Thank you. So if you wonder if I will be lenient to you, who's not a member of my own family, here's what I did to my own family when they crossed me. So just a little hint if you want to know what you should do. So the pressure was severe. Coming out of the Council of Arles, or Nice, there were two dissenters, and they were both killed. Arius was essentially poisoned. So let's come down to Revelation 12, verse 4. And his tail, this is this dragon, this red dragon, and his tail drew the third part of the stars of heaven, did cast them to the earth, and the dragon stood before the woman, which was ready to be delivered, for to devour her child as soon as it was born. Here's Constantine, who really wants control. The Roman Empire really wants control of this woman. Well, the political pressures of the civil power caused some of the church teachers, these stars, to be degraded and support the worldly goals of Rome. It had been weakened. It had been weakened by prosperity and popularity and favor. That weakens the church. It doesn't strengthen it. It weakens it. Many in the church had become soft in the 40 years before the Diocletian persecutions, and many others were merely like the people of the land. You know, when Israel had gone back and they're building the temple, they didn't want the people of the land to start building the temple. Well, what had happened? They're inviting the world. They're inviting the people of the land. Yeah. It's weakening them. And they just became Christians for prosperity. But there were several who still held to the true principles of sacrifice, that God was overruling things for their spiritual welfare. No matter what happens, no matter how bad it gets, this is what God wants for us, because this is what we need. He's the one who knows how to create a divine being. We don't. So let's not try to take the steering wheel out of his hands and steer towards, you know, the rest area. Let's keep on the highway that he's prescribing for us, this walk in the narrow way. Well, the ones who were very upset with these compromisers, these were the Donatists and others who insisted that the Christian bishops who had surrendered the scriptures during the Diocletian persecution, that these guys should no longer be considered as having any office or power in the Christian church. You've compromised. You threw away your faith. This is a way of sacrifice. You weren't willing to do it. You can't be a leader and a teacher. We don't recognize you anymore. The Donatists were right. They were right. These true Christians knew that persecution brings clarity and strength. Clarity and strength. I remember when I was a kid, we lived in New York, Pennsylvania. It was when Three Mile Island was about to melt down. And my dad said to my mom, Roberta, have you packed? Packed everything we need. Well, what have you packed? She said, the pictures of my children. Everything else we can replace. When this tremendous incident was about to happen, you might lose everything you own. It's real simple to say, what's most precious to me? It brought clarity and strength. She was ready. Sacrifice and persecution brings clarity and strength to us, because that's really when we get to show to ourselves and to God what's most important. So these true Christians knew that the persecution would bring clarity and strength to the true church. They also knew and they had seen that luxury and ease bring selfishness, compromise, and worldliness. On to Revelation 12:5. And she brought forth the true church, brought forth this man child. So now they're separate. Notice when you bring it forth, the association is not as close. It's a good thing. this man-child who was to rule all nations with a rod of iron. Now, this was not happen right then and there, but this was a gradual process that would take several centuries to develop. And her child was caught up unto God and to his throne. Well, this man-child, this is the beginnings of what would become papacy, the church united with the world, with a man as its head. Now, initially, it seems this was Constantine, who was Pontifex Maximus. He was the head of the church. But later, there would be a transition. This would be a huge paradigm shift where Pontifex Maximus is no longer the emperor. Because keep in mind, for the pagan religions, religion was just a manifestation of state rule. But here we have Pontifex Maximus, who is the head of a religious organization, not initially associated. I mean, not where the sole goal of that religious organization, the church, was not, or at least initially they were saying, this isn't for world domination, this is for serving God. That's essentially what they're saying. So it's a huge paradigm shift for Pontifex Maximus to go to the head of the church instead of the head of the empire. So this man-child would gradually claim the place of God in authority over the Christian world and over the word of God itself. On to Revelation 12:6. And the woman fled into the wilderness, where she hath a place prepared of God, that they should feed her there 1,260 days. So, here we're seeing what's happening. We have this worldly church develop and eventually have temporal power. The power to persecute is developing. So the ones who truly want to sacrifice, the ones who don't want to adhere to this orthodox Nicene religion, what choice do they have? Well, you got to get out of town, literally and symbolically. They can't be a part of this organization, so they flee into the wilderness. And the time is given to us, the 1260 years, 539 to 1799. Now notice the wilderness. When you think of the wilderness, usually you can't call it the wilderness unless there's a city. You know, it's a contrast. Well, what was the city? The city was Babylon. The wilderness is something apart from it. Now the church actually wants to be part of a city, but not that one. So they want to be part of is a new Jerusalem, whose builder and maker is God. But that's not now. That's going to be in the future. So they had to get away from the city that had been developed with papacy and the empire and flee into the wilderness. So she flees into this wilderness, a condition of fidelity to the Lord, apart from the influence of the apostate church, but still under its jurisdiction and dominion. And we're going to see more about that later, because they were going to be persecuted throughout this 1,260-year period. Well, as we start going closer to 539, we're going to see things happening. 539, we have temporal power that is given to papacy, not merely in words, but actually in reality. But the apostate church was hungry for the power and the earthly advantage that would allow, this earthly elevation that it would allow if they were able to get temporal power. But there are a few things hindering that as well. Well, in Volume 2, and Gibbon, Volume 2, page 108, and this is quoted in the second volume in the Man of Sin chapter, Brother Russell mentions the emperors succeeding Constantine down to Theodosius continued, so this is before 539, but it's after Constantine. They continued to regard themselves as the heads of the church. So these are the emperors. They said, we're the emperor, we're the head of the church, in whom centered divine authority. Though no one of the 1,800 bishops of the empire was yet prepared to demand recognition as the head or pope, several had their eyes on it. You know, they're salivating over this. They really wanted to be seen as head of the church. I am the Pontifex Maximus. That's what they wanted. They saw this as a prize. And the emperors were gradually shown the shallowness of their claims to the title Pontifex Maximus in the argument. Now notice this argument. Since the emperors worshipped dead saints, they owed a similar respect to their living representatives, the bishops. Interesting logic. Well, if you worship the dead saint who's just like me, you should worship me. You should venerate me. So they're doing anything they can to try to become Pontifex Maximus. Again, this would be a huge paradigm shift. Pontifex Maximus had always been the head of the empire, but the Bishop of Rome wanted this title and authority. And if he had it, there would be no limit to the earthly elevation of papacy. There would be no limit. Well, in 1334, Constantine moved the seat of power from Rome to Constantinople, hundreds and hundreds of miles away. And this eventually left the Bishop of Rome as the most prominent person in Rome. So, I mean, he had the most prominent palace, garb, you know, pomp, circumstance. He was the sort of the big guy on the block now in Rome. Well, in 455, there was a Vandal invasion. 455, again, this is about 80 years before Justinian. There's a Roman, a Vandal invasion in Rome. Well, Leo, the Bishop of Rome, of course the Catholics will call him Pope Leo, here's what he does. He arrays himself in his fancy duds, his pontifical robes, you know, very glorious looking, to try to, you know, ostentatious, try to overawe and impress. And that, this again is in the second volume, in the Manichean. He says, "Beware, I am the successor of Saint Peter, to whom God has given the keys of the kingdom of heaven and against whose church the gates of hell cannot prevail. I am the living representative of divine power on the earth. I give and take away by divine right all thrones and principalities of Christendom." Now notice, even before he has temporal power, he's claiming authority over the thrones of Christendom. "Bow down your necks to me and pray that the anger of God may be averted." Interesting. Really taking a whole lot upon himself, showing what his real desire is. What he already thinks of himself, he just hasn't got the emperor to acknowledge it. Well, one thing to note is that the empire is not just going to give away power. They're not just going to give things away for free. It's only when they're under tremendous pressure. And that's what happened to Justinian. And let's see this. This is on third volume, page 70 and 71. The Emperor Justinian feared that religious disputes might divide the church and thus divide the empire, which he was desirous of more firmly uniting. Because even in that early day, the nominal church and the empire were considered one and the same. They were considered as Christendom. And he desired to have some authority and a standard to settle these religious disputes and to tell the people what to believe and what to disbelieve. And he found that the Bishop of Rome was already the most popular. Most folks had regard for him. The Bishop of Rome was considered the most orthodox, the most in harmony with the emperor. So Justinian, by documents, he recognized the Bishop of Rome as the head of all the holy churches and desired to assist this pope in putting down the heresy and in establishing the unity of the church and therefore the unity of the empire. Now, why was he doing this? Was he religiously minded? Is that what he was interested in? Well, what's the most urgent thing a country can do? They're willing to go into trillions of dollars of debt. I mean, that's today. They're going into debt, marshal hundreds or thousands of people. War, that's it. When all of a sudden the life of your country, your empire is at stake, war. That's the thing that's been the motivator of technology, of so many things, of virtually all the debt we have, and all throughout the ages. Well, Brother also goes on to say, no doubt indeed the object of Justinian in acknowledging the claims of the Bishop of Rome to superiority over others was also in the part to gain his cooperation in the war he was about to wage against the Ostrogoths, which went from 539 to about 540. He wanted to regain Italy as a part of the Eastern Roman Empire, because it had been alienated. We want to get it back. We want them to help us in this war. For the influence of the Pope and the Church was by no means inconsiderable even then, and to have them on his side in the war was half the conquest already won at the very outset. So this is for military and political expedience. It had very little to do with religion. Just fix up these squabbles with the religion, whatever it is. Make everybody believe the same thing. You take care of that so that everybody's on our side in the war. In other words, Justinian recognized the Pope as the head of the Church so he could unite the empire and win the war. Justinian saw this as expedience. The Pope saw this as triumph. This surely was a small thing in the mind of Justinian. These are just a few ideas. I mean, just tell people what to believe. But this is something that the Church of Rome had wanted now for centuries, to be considered as Pontifex Maximus. Well, this was the little horn of Daniel 7, verse 8. In Daniel 7, verse 8, I considered the horns, and behold, there came up among them a little horn, before whom there were three of the first horns plucked up by the roots. And that was really during this time. There was the Eastern Exarchate, the Ostrogoths, the Eastern Exarchate, and the Hierarchy. I'm not sure if I have them in the proper order. But the Goths were the last ones to be uprooted. And behold, in this horn were eyes like the eyes of man and a mouth speaking great things. If you go back to when the Pope, when Leo was talking to the Vandals, he didn't come out with a huge army and threaten them with swords and, you know, catapults. It was just words. He was just trying to overawe them with words. That's how this was done. Well, by 539, the Pope had temporal power and the full backing of the empire to quell heresies and religious disputes. So the true Church, which was at variance with orthodoxy, they had only one thing they could do. They had to flee into the wilderness. We got to get out of the city, go into the wilderness. Away from orthodoxy, away from this church-state arrangement which forced them to uniformity in this false religion. Well, as time went on, papacy assumed more and more temporal authority and power and was eventually crowning the kings and emperors. And we'd have to go on several centuries, you know, several centuries before you get to Charlemagne, before you get in 800, before you get to the Inquisitions. Before that, this authority is growing over centuries and centuries. And it's interesting when you look at the Pope and you look at the Roman Catholic Church, they plan for decades and centuries ahead, whereas the emperors, they plan for the empire during their lifetime. One thing about the emperors you notice, especially in the emperors, the Caesars. Do you ever notice the Caesars planning for a retirement program? Is there any need for that? Their retirement program was usually they'd be poisoned, or they'd be a sword, or one of the relatives, or another general. They were all vying. It's like the emperors, they're not looking at things over hundreds of years. They're looking at things over the term of their own power. That was really the extent of it. Whereas the Church of Rome, they were looking at things over the span of centuries. They were working this intrigue over centuries. So this assuming of this power, more and more temporal authority, was something that really took a long time. Well, we'll go on to Revelation 12, 7 through 9. And there was a war in heaven. Michael and his angels fought against the dragon, and the dragon fought and his angels. and prevailed not, neither was there a place found any more in heaven. And the great dragon was cast out, that old serpent, called the devil and Satan, which deceiveth the whole world. And he was cast out into the earth, and his angels were cast out with him. Well, this war in heaven, this was a war for initially for ecclesiastical control. Who's going to be Pontifex Maximus? Who's really using Pontifex Maximus to the greatest ability it could be? So if you have a war for the Pontifex Maximus and all the power that this could lead to, that's what papacy we're looking for. Well, it says Michael is doing this. Now, Michael is a name, and the meaning of the name is who as God. Michael was the name of 8 different men of Israel. And if you look at all the men of the Bible or do a search, you can see that, different men who had this name. But I think Michael is also not just a name, it's also a descriptor. In other words, it's a description of the one who is being referred to as Michael. Now, who as God? In other words, this is a name that says it's used to show agency. One who is acting in the place and authority of God. In other words, I'm the agent of God. That's what Michael is saying. Who as God? In Daniel 10, the Logos acted as God's agent or representative to defeat the prince of Persia, Satan. And so he could then help Gabriel, and Gabriel would come to Daniel's aid. Or in Daniel 12:1, where Michael shall stand up, take his authority. Here, this is used to describe the returned Lord. He's returning as the representative of God and the general of Jehovah. He is the agent of God. He's God's agent. He's not doing his own will. He's still doing God's will. It's always God's plan. This is also shown in Psalm 98, verse 1. Sing unto the Lord a new song, for he hath done marvelous things. His right hand, his holy arm, has gotten him the victory. Well, who could that be? That's the resurrected Lord. That's his agent. That's his right arm. That's his agency. But in Revelation 12:7, this Michael is making claims that he is God's agent. Remember what we talked about when he was talking to the Vandals? I am God's representative. That's what he's saying. And this concept is emphasized earlier by Paul in 2 Thessalonians 2, verses 3 and 4. Where he says, let no man deceive you by any means, for that day shall not come except there come a falling away, and that man of sin be revealed, the son of perdition, who opposeth and exalteth himself above all that is called God, or that is worship, so that he as God, who as God, he as God, same concept, sitteth in the temple of God, showing himself that he is God. Essentially, he's saying, I'm God's agent. I'm God's agent. I've got the power of God. I'm his representative. That's what he's saying here. And after he's gotten Pontifex Maximus, you know, you can look at the quotes where he says, what can you make me but God? I mean, it's so difficult to read that and comprehend that, but that anybody would make statements like this. Well, this war in heaven that's talked about, you know, there's this war in heaven. The word war really means bustle. You know, it's this power struggle. And this power struggle was not just simply with Justinian. This was really over centuries with many emperors. In other words, it's almost like, the boa constrictor. He's going to wrap around you a little bit and get a little tighter and a little tighter. And this is over centuries and centuries. Pretty soon you find this thing is all wrapped around, and the kings of the Roman Empire really don't have the authority they had. This is now the Pope's, and he's now the head of the Holy Roman Empire. Well, eventually papacy was controlling the empire. The dragon, really showing civil Rome or pagan Rome, this part of it is cast out. cast out of this position of chief control. The civil power was then used by papacy to chase the woman and wear out the saints of the Most High, from mentioned in Daniel 7:27. This eventually resulted in inquisitions and murdering millions of the saints. I mean, millions of Protestants who saints. They couldn't have been all saints, but certainly they had ideas contrary to papacy. So if you look at the Diocletian persecution, that was a drop in the bucket compared to what papacy did over the years. In Revelation 12:10, and I heard a loud voice saying in heaven, now is come salvation and strength in the kingdom of our God and the power of Christ, for the accuser of our brethren is cast down, which accused them before God day and night. Well, papacy claimed that the power of God and Christ had gotten this victory to bless the world through them. You know, they overcame the Roman Empire, etc. Verse 11, and they overcame him by the blood of the Lamb and the word of their testimony, and they loved not their lives unto death. Well, papacy had claimed that their victory was because of their own fidelity to the word of God, to their sacrificing spirit, to their support of Christ. But no, it was because of their subtle influence and political conniving over centuries. In verse 12, therefore rejoice, ye heavens, and ye that dwell in them. Woe to the inhabitants of the earth and of the sea, for the devil has come down unto you, having great wrath, because he knoweth that he hath but a short time. And when the dragon saw that he was cast under the earth, he persecuted the woman which brought forth the man-child. Well, these heavens that are being talked about, these heavens are those who are in spiritual control now, and those who supported papacy and are blasphemous doctrines. They were sucking up to the papacy. That's where the control was. That's where the power was. They were glad. And anybody who thought something else was deemed a heretic. We're going to talk about the word heretic and define exactly what. Heretic's a really good word, by the way. But they were, it has a very bad connotation. They were deemed heretics or pagans, and they'd be persecuted by papacy through the civil power which she now controlled. Look at the St. Bartholomew's Night and the killing of over 50,000 Huguenots in France, where blood literally ran in the streets. A papal medal was struck. I've got a picture of it on my computer. The Diocletian persecutions paled in comparison to one night of persecutions by papacy. But in Revelation 12:14, and to the woman were given two wings of a great eagle, that she might fly into the wilderness, into her place, where she is nourished for a time and times and half a time. Here's the 1260 years, yet again, showing this span of time in Revelation 12. From the face of the serpent. So the woman, the true church, in the wilderness, in this condition, separate, you know, mentally separate from the influence of these terrible religious doctrines of papacy, she was given the strength of the two wings, the Old and the New Testament, to the extent that they could be revealed at that time and were available. And in my studies, it's a lot more extensive than I originally thought. She didn't have all the truths, but she was enabled to see the errors. And I think that's a very big thing. Do you have enough truth to see what error is? That's a big, big difference. Well, so note that Revelation 12 shows the 1260-year period span twice, both in verses 6 and 14. Well, she remained in this wilderness condition, apart from the city, apart from Babylon, all through the 1260 years of papacy's temporal power, and even afterwards. Now, after that power persecuted, that wilderness condition was not as severe. Bible societies, other things happened. But the kings in Europe still wanted religious uniformity. They still saw religion as a way to control the people. In fact, the Waldenses really didn't have the freedom to be Waldenses until 1848, I believe. 1848. So they still had some persecutions. So, and we're still in the wilderness. We don't want to be part of the religious mainstream. We're still apart. We're still waiting for the New Jerusalem. Well, the kings of the earth had been, during this 1260-year period, drunken with the lies and claims of papacy. Revelation 17:2, with whom the kings of the earth have committed fornication, and the inhabitants of the earth had made drunk with the wine of her fornication. For all nations have drunk of the wine of the wrath of her fornication, and the kings of the earth had committed fornication with her. And the merchants have waxed rich. So there's Revelation chapter 12, and we're going to be going under Revelation 17. But what we want to do now is make time really go slowly. I don't think that's going to happen. But what we want to do is, I guess in part two mainly, is we want to go back before Christianity. Before the Gospel Age, to look at the status of religion itself, both true religion and false religion. We're going to start out a little bit here. Now, when God had manifested himself to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, he led the sons of Jacob out of Egyptian bondage through his work with Moses and established a covenant with Israel, the sons of Jacob. And this was to be a theocracy, very important, a theocracy, where all the laws came from God himself through Moses. Moses didn't say, I wrote this, and God gave his approval. He said, these are from God himself. So the responsibility of Israel was to understand, interpret, and enforce them. Israel had no authority to write their own laws. They all had to come directly from God. In Deuteronomy 31:10 through 12, and I really love this, it says, Moses commanded them, this is the priests, saying, and the Levites, says, at the end of every 7 years, in the solemnity of the year of release, you will read this law before all Israel in their hearing. In other words, God wanted all of Israel to know this. Don't just take the priest's word for it. They're going to read it from these books. And we'd like you to also, if you could read them yourself, that'd be good. But I want you to understand this so you may hear, you may learn, and reverence the Lord your God and observe to do all the words of this law. And if we come all the way down to Jesus' day, we'll see that there were various interpretations. They had the Talmud and the traditions of the elders. But the whole idea was everything was supposed to go back to the law of God, what God had given to them with as little deviation as possible. There was supposed to be uniformity in what God had given them. But during this Jewish age, the Gentiles were doing their thing as well. The Gentile kingdoms and the empires, they were governed by human laws. For better, for worse. Hopefully that they were for better. Some were bad. But virtually all of these kingdoms wanted the sanction of some god to claim that some god was guiding them, directing them, and blessing them as the king or the emperor. They wanted the endorsement of God. So they, you know, just make up a god and then claim it. That's essentially what paganism did. Some went to the extreme to claim that their king or Caesar or emperor was God. Well, these claims, if they were believed, they'd help them to rule with absolute power and eliminate any attempt to threaten the emperor and his authority. We're going to stop right there. But one thing I want to see is both the true religion was saying uniformity, no other gods, everybody's going to believe the same thing, read the law every 7 years. The false religion says, hey, the king, that you know, you're going to worship this god because he's blessing the emperor. And you're not going to worship any other gods. You're going to worship the god or set of gods that's blessing and guiding and directing the emperor, because the emperor is not only the head of the empire, he's Pontifex Maximus. So whether it's the Jews or whether it's the Gentiles, in both of those worlds, there's absolute uniformity of religion. One is the true, all the others are false. But what I want to see in the second part of this is how does that affect society and how does it affect the true church? Thank you, brother.